So I'm going to be introducing some of the reinforcement learning stuff. I also just want to reiterate that tomorrow there'll be a tutorial on that. So I'm going to go over some basics. I'm going to drop a few of the keywords you'll hear again tomorrow. Feel free to interrupt me if you want me to explain them. That's true for the general talk, by the way. I'd hope to keep this informal. Just ask away if you want. So this is work in collaboration with Jens Eisert and a postdoc and student of his. And you can find more details in that reference if you want. These pictures will become clear as we go. So this talk, basically, to give you a summary right up front, is composed of two concepts. One is error correction for a quantum computer, and the other is reinforcement learning. And I hope to convince you today that in a particular case that I will describe, reinforcement learning is a very natural algorithm to try and do error correction with. You might have seen that Google managed to beat the master players at Go. There's a connection to that too later on, which I hope will become clear. So I try to keep this sort of basic tutorial-ish. If I'm going too slow, just let me know. I can speed up. But I want to start with explaining where these pictures come from, and that requires me to go back a little bit further, namely to the classical world, where we all know this thing, a bit of information, can be a 0 or a 1, and then you have a physical implementation of that bit. Let's say typically people talk about transistors, can be many other things, switches, and then you have, you know, your favorite implementation of those. But something happens, temperature happens, either storage or when you try and send that bit of information to other people, something gets corrupted. One of those bits, let's say, flips from a 1 to a 0. And if all I give you is this and you never knew what I wanted to send you, there's no way for you to find out what the actual data was. And the standard way of fixing this, I think almost, I guess, I'd say all error correction codes are based on this concept, is the keyword redundancy, right? You just want to encode your information in such a way that you can afford to have errors happen and still be able to correct them. The most trivial thing you can do here is this majority rule, where instead of having my single bit, I encode that bit in three other bits. That I trade this capacity of being able to error freely or correct errors or to mitigate the problem of errors at the cost of having to have more hardware. And so that's a typical, you've all seen this. If I encode the bits 0, 1, 0, that'll become this set of 9 bits. Now, you know, if I'm lucky enough and my error rate isn't super high, as long as only one out of those 3 bits in each of those sets flips, I can take a majority rule and correct it, right? Just because I can, and you might see that pop up more often. People typically talk about like such a notation for codes, 3-1-3 codes, which basically says I'm using 3 bits in this case to encode one so-called logical bit, right? 0 or 1 here. And that 3 refers to the distance of the code. That's something that will come up later. That just basically tells you if you take that number 3, which is this D here, which is the Hamming distance of that code, that tells you how many bits, how many errors can you have before you can no longer correct, right? So in this case, if 2 of these bits flip, I have a majority of 1, and so I incorrectly correct this bit from a 0 to 1, right? Which means I can have at most 1 bit flip here, which is exactly what this number tells you. So much for classical, because I want to go to quantum. Things change a little bit. They change dramatically, but we're all familiar with that. Now I have quantum bits that I, for easiness, just represent like this. I have 2 states, 0 and 1. That's called the eigenstates of Pauli Z operator. I'm writing Z, X, Y for the Pauli operators, no sigmas, in true spirit of quantum information notation. And of course, there's a constraint on these complex numbers. And instead of transistors now, we have our favorite implementation, and it's up, you know, some people prefer superconducting circuits. Majorana modes, of course, are being investigated very close by. All of these are completely valuable and valid implementations of quantum bits. But this superposition, let's say, or this particular quantum state, has a problem. Namely, we have errors on those two. Two typical errors that I'll discuss here are so-called bit flip noise, which is basically applying a Pauli X flip to that, which just swaps out the 0 and the 1. Or a phase flip, which just introduces a negative, like a minus sign, to one of them. You can have the combination of those, called depolarizing noise, which corresponds to a Y. But if I imagine that I give you this particular state, right, and you'd want to find out what the coefficient of that 0 is to see if I even ever happened or not, you'd have to measure it and collapse it, right? That's an issue. Perhaps more importantly, if I want to try and do the naive thing and do this repetition code that we did for classical, you immediately have the issue that you cannot just clone your bits, right? So I cannot take my bit and make two copies of it or multiple copies of it. So that redundancy encoding in terms of repetition code doesn't work here, which means we need a clever way of encoding our single qubits, being able to also decode them, meaning find out which error happened. And if we know that, you want to be able to correct them, all without, you know, destroying our quantum information. This might be all super familiar to you. I just want to have all of this said. So a way, an example, what I'm going to build up to is surface codes. If you already know those, bear with me for a little bit longer. A clever way of doing that, for example, starts with this, often called Shor's code for Peter Shor. Where I do the following, maybe come falls out of the sky for a little bit. I have my logical qubit, my 0 tilde, my 1 tilde, and I'm still using three physical qubits, hardware qubits. But I choose this particular superposition and this particular superposition to represent my two logical states. And out of those, I build my quantum state, which here is again a 3-1 code. Three physical qubits to represent one logical qubit. And if you notice, if you look, if you stare at these and you ask, what can I do with them? There's an important property, namely that these two states are both simultaneous eigenstates with value plus one, eigenvalue plus one, of this particular combination of Pauli operators. Z1, Z2, also Z2, Z3. You see, right? Z1, Z2, doesn't matter. Here I get two positive signs. Z1, Z2, even if the one gives me a negative sign, I measure two of them. I have no sign flip. So that's an important feature that is I'm going to come back to in the next slides. That's what I just said. They're both simultaneous eigenstates of these operators, which means I can now do the following clever thing. If a single bit flip error happens on one of those qubits, let's say in qubit number one. In this case, the logical zero state turns into this, logical one turns into that. I continue to measure, I check again, are they still eigenstates with eigenvalue plus one of this Z1, Z2 operators? And you will see that for this particular error, one of them has a negative, has a minus sign here, right? And I never actually find out what the state of that qubit is. I only know the state of Z1, Z2, of qubit 1 and 2, or the measurement of Z on 1 and 2, and on 2 and 3, which is going to tell me exactly where the error happened, right? Because if there's a negative sign here, that means it happened on the first or the second. Knowing that it didn't happen on the second or the third means it must have been the first. I hope that's clear. Okay, so I can make a small table of that. I look at these operators, Z1, Z2, Z2, Z3, and I check what the eigenvalues are for measuring those operators, given that the first qubit, second qubit, or third qubit flipped, or nothing happened. And what comes out is a particular pattern of ones and minus ones. Okay, and the point is that this pattern, if I'm clever and I choose these operators, etc., and the states correctly, I'll come back to that, then that pattern, called the syndrome, is unique. Okay. So I have my three qubits. Let's I have my 3 qubits, I measure these operators all the time, and I check which pattern I get. Given that pattern, I know exactly which error happened without ever having to have measured all those qubits and projected. Okay. Now, going to that thing, just for pedagogical purposes, all you have to do, of course, is take those operators, take the errors that you want, and all you need to know is commutation or anti-commutation relations, right? Because what happens to this thing if an X1 flips? You see here, all I have to care about is that it's moving that X1 past the Z, which we know what happens there. I get a minus sign. So all of this can be summarized by knowing commutation relations. And as a preparation for what the pictures I'm going to show you, you can also represent this in an image. I have my 3 qubits, 1, 2, and 3. And if an error happens, let's say if I flip qubit number 1, then I will have, if I measure Z1, Z2, so I measure on the bond between these two, I'll have a minus 1 here, which is often indicated with a little dot. If I have an error here, I get red dots here. So that pattern of dots is just a way of representing which syndrome I get. All right. Those were the bit flips. No, Pauli X operators. I told you in the beginning there's also phase flips in which I change the sign. Those cannot be captured correctly with those 3 qubits, but we can extend this to have 3 copies, of that same set of 3. So now I construct this particular superposition out of 9 qubits. Don't have to go through all that, but you can convince yourself that this state in particular, is a simultaneous eigenstate of both these two sets of operators. And again, now if a phase flip error happens, all I have to do is do that commutation relation, which is exactly the Z1 and the X1 identical to before, and you get a particular pattern of errors happening here. So with these 9 qubits, I can also start recognizing phase flip errors. Okay. Putting all of that together gives you a set of operators. We had these before, Z1, Z2, and identities on the rest, Z2, Z3. We saw those for the 3 qubits. Now I have to extend that by Z4 up to Z9 for these other qubits, and those 2 strings of X operators. So now the thing is, the claim is, or there's not a claim, you can easily verify that, if you take this particular state for the 0 tilde and the one with the minus signs for the 1 tilde, and you measure each of these operators, each of those gives you a particular unique set of 1s and minus 1s as measurement values that tells you exactly which error happened. Okay. So with these 9, at the cost of having 9 qubits, 9 physical Majorana modes or superconducting qubits, I can encode 1 logical quantum bit. And this is what is known as a simple form of stabilizer codes, right? These operators are called stabilizers, and they tell me exactly, if I measure all of them, they tell me exactly with their syndrome pattern which errors occurred. You can do a bit better than this. For example, for 1 logical qubit, it suffices to have 5 Majoranas or spins or ions, superconducting circuits. And the whole point is, I take those operators, my logical states are those 2, in this case, that are simultaneous plus 1 eigenstates of these operators. And if an error happens, I can always tell which error happened where by obtaining that syndrome measurement. Okay. Go ahead.
So one thing I don't quite get is that what if the phase flip is not a minus 1 error,
yep,
but the phase error, like actual phase, has a complex one?
Yep. I'm going to tell you all about that afterwards.
Okay.
I don't want to go into that detail now, but typically what we consider, let's say if you think about quantum circuits, we'll have, I don't want to complicate things.
I can wait.
If you know how to correct these phase flips, you can do more complex things too. I can tell you all about that after. Okay. All right. Stabilize our codes. We do a little bit better in the form of so-called surface codes. That's where these pictures come in. So this is a picture of a single logical qubit. This, the whole state, I should tell you first. Each of these vertices represents a physical qubit. Right? Imagine a small superconducting circuit on each of those points, or a Majorana mode. So I have a ton of physical qubits here. The whole state represents one logical qubit, okay? Meaning a zero or a one quantum bit. And the stabilizers in this case are these colored plaquettes, namely the product of four Z operators on those corners, like the two Z operators we had before, or the Z1, Z2. Now we have them here. So I should say a single stabilizer, for example, is Z's on these corners and identities everywhere else, but also Z's on these corners and identities everywhere else. So there is 16, 24 stabilizers here. And you can ask, if I take all those operators, can I write down eigenstates of all those operators that are simultaneous plus one eigenstates? You can. Turns out there's two of them, a one and a zero. So this whole system encodes a single logical qubit. Right? I hope that picture is clear. You can make that periodic, and it turns into the toric code. This is usually known as a surface code.
And you said you can do it a little bit better, but what's that mean? What's wrong with Shor's code? Why don't we use it?
Oh, so the thing that you gain here is error strings. Errors will happen in this form. You need to ask yourself, if I have that logical zero state and a logical one state, what is the worst that can happen for which I can no longer distinguish the two, right? In this case, it turns out that information from or zero and one is encoded globally in that whole thing. I'm skipping ahead a bit, but that means if I want to have an error occur in this system that changes my logical qubit from a zero to a one, I'm going to have to flip as many qubits as the length of my system is. So for a given distance, I can do a bit better. It's more robust. I encode the qubit 0 and 1 in a global feature, in this case topological. I can have errors happening in the middle that won't affect my logical state.
The 5 code only allows for one error. Right?
The 5 code only allows for one error. Okay, fine. And here I can have 1, 2, 3, 4 errors without anything changing my code. Thanks. Okay, good. So, red dots that I showed you before. If I have those stabilizers, and if I do have, let's say, in this middle vertex, let's say I have a Z flip, or I have an X error flip happen, those result in particular patterns of syndromes. Okay. That means, what this red dot means is if I flip this qubit with a Z operator here, now I measure this stabilizer, I measure the x's, this guy here, I find a minus one, okay? That's what happens to the x, this is what happens to the y, and again, the way to see that is just if I have that z operator here, this z obviously commutes with this stabilizer on this plaquette, because it's all z's, it doesn't commute with all the x's here. Right? It's just counting how many z's and x's you have. Clear? All right. So, like I said, there is a particular thing that you can do to this system that flips your zero to your one state. I'm not going into all the detail. We can do the math behind that if you want. But if I want to change from a zero logical to a one logical, I'm going to have to flip qubits in a string that touches the boundaries. That's the only way in which the zero can go to a one, or in this case, with a Z string. Doesn't have to be a straight line. This string of x's can snake through that lattice. But as long as it doesn't connect to boundaries, you will not change from a zero to a one. So you can suffer all those errors without having to worry about your data. Okay. The thing that I should say here is that you see there's errors happening. There's no red dots, and that's just because if this x happens, you get a red dot here and here. this x also gets you a red dot here, and two red dots cancel, simply because these two x's with that z operator commutes. That's it. So if all I give you is this picture, and I don't show you that these errors happened, you don't see any red dots, you might assume everything is fine. But it's not, because I have a string of x's flipped. So that's basically the whole thing that I wanted to get at, which is now the following decoding problem. I give you this picture, and I ask you which set of errors happened. This is the game we're going to play, right? And I'm going to just flash forth back and forth a couple of times this thing. You might see some parallels, okay? I give you a particular configuration of a game board, in this case the Surface game, or in this case this game, and all I ask you is, given that configuration, for example, what is the best next move I can make, okay? In this case, there's a whole machinery behind here that we actually implemented that I think is a bit overkill for error correction, but it's fun nonetheless. But a central component of this is reinforcement learning. How does an algorithm teach itself to play Go, or chess, or tic-tac-toe? Tic-tac-toe is a particular example that's particularly easy, for which you don't need it, but their reinforcement learning is a central component in that, so I want to go over reinforcement learning. As a disclaimer for myself, all your hard questions should be referred to Dries tomorrow. Feel free to ask them anyway, no guarantees. So the idea of reinforcement learning is super simple. It's when you're a child, you run, you hit a wall, it hurts, you hopefully don't do that again. There's reinforcement, in this case negative. You update your state, your description of the world, and hopefully learn that you shouldn't do that. So that's the whole idea behind reinforcement learning, is that I have a situation, a state of the environment, could be whatever the system I'm interested in, and I can perform some action on that environment. And the whole idea behind reinforcement learning is for me to train myself, to teach myself, or to learn what is the best course of action I can take. Okay, how do I achieve my goal? As far as I know, the hello world example in reinforcement learning is, for example, this card pull, in which you try to balance a stick on a pole. There's an agent, typically in this case me, trying to do that. So I need a couple of ingredients. I have my environment, the state of the system I'm interested in. I have a particular task I want to perform, but I have some actions at my disposal that I can choose from. And most importantly, this is where the difficulty comes in, there is a reward. So how this works is, in this case, I have a system described by a coordinate, its current speed, and let's say the angle of this stick. And every time step in the simulation, that's the state of the system. And every time step, the agent that is trying to optimize, in this case, trying to keep that stick upright as long as it can apply a force to that card, pushing it left or right. And every time the agent does make such a move on the environment, the environment changes a bit, responds to that. And in particular, the environment gives you a reward. It tells you, you did something correctly or incorrectly. There's many different ways in which this can happen. In this case, we can imagine, if we want to maximize that reward, I can choose to reward the agent for keeping that angle close to 90 degrees or 0 degrees, for example, in this case. Let's say 90 is a good score, pi is a good score, so pi minus something is always worse. I can also decide to reward the agent only at the end. It can do whatever it wants, and I just give him as many points equal to the time for which it managed to keep that stick, within 5 degrees. There's many other ways you can think of rewarding, of teaching in a system to do that, and I think that's where the difficulty in reinforcement learning is, designing that environment and what the reward is that you should give the agent. The consequences of that can be various. It could be that both of them learn the same strategy. One just does so faster. We can discuss all of those things later. Another thing I mentioned, you can do tic-tac-toe, where it's easier to imagine the state of the system is just this particular state. The reward I get is, did I win or not? And the actions I can take is, you know, the open squares. Okay. So the idea is, I should have said that earlier. Initially, that agent, you know, does something random. The pole immediately falls. So whatever it did that made that pole fall must have been a bad thing, or it didn't get a large reward. So it tries to do something else next time. And as long as you keep repeating that, you hope that the agent starts learning how to do better. If you do want much more information, this is a very good reference, free book you can find online, all you need to know and want to know about reinforcement learning. If you want more examples, OpenAI Jim gives you a Python environment, basically, that has set up environments. The card pole is in there, many other things, like this thing is in there. And this is always fun to watch for me. This is the same agent, only tasked with getting as far on the parkour as it can, right? The only reward here is how many meters did you manage to run, okay? The actions are, you know, move your muscles. Initially, it just falls over, does nothing. But at some point, it starts learning that if I fall and make a step, I get another meter, I get another point, okay? Here, you can also ask, can I do better rewards? Can I reward, you know, more balance? But you see that these systems, it's a very intuitive way of learning. Right? You just have a reward. In this case, you can try billions of times. And at some point, you learn a gait. You learn how to walk. And if you haven't seen the movie, you should look them up on YouTube. If you've ever wondered if walking on the moon by jumping like this is optimal, if you ask such an untrained agent to find the best way of walking on the moon, you find indeed that they have this. Okay, fine. In practice, I told you about this agent that makes choices. There are many algorithms that train such an agent, and I want to discuss Q-learning quickly. Q-learning, I think of initially as having a table that says, for every state of my system, think of tic-tac-toe, for every configuration of my game, I want to know what the action is that I should take, right? And initially, that table is empty. But then I find that if there's two crosses set up for me and I put the cross in the right position, I win. I get a positive reward. So I update my table to reflect that if I ever see the situation in which I can win by putting my cross in a third position, I should take that. I should do that. So that particular action for state with two crosses in a row, the action of putting the cross in that particular position should be the highest value. And you should think of that as a simple, like a strategy. It's often in reinforcement learning called a policy of the agent that just says, for a given action, for a given state, what is the action I should take? How do you train? How do you do that in practice? Dries will tell you all about that tomorrow. I think you can just write down the idea that if I'm in a given state, I have a reward waiting for me, either immediately or at the very end, namely, am I going to win or not? So what I want to do is update the table such that for a given state, I maximize the reward that I'm expecting, right? That's what this says. There's a reward that I'm expecting, but the reward, including like the next actions that I might be taking with some decay factors and discount rate. Details of that I'm not going to go and discuss here. There's one obvious complaint you might have here is that for tic-tac-toe, that's fine. For Go, you know, Go is played on 19 by 19 squares. Each square can be either empty, black, or white. So that's 3 to the power 19 times 19 configurations that you have to stick in a table. And, okay, I think we agree that's something we can forget about. That's not going to ever fit in memory. So that's not a good idea in general for systems with large state spaces. Two modifications we can make to also work, to also have reinforcement learning work in those cases. One is not essential, but one is what is being done for AlphaGo and for playing Go, and also what we do for the error correction, is that instead of having a value for the action, what I want to be thinking about is that policy that says, for a given state of my system, what is the probability that I should pick action 1 or action up to n? Right? It's not an essential modification, that's just an easy way or a convenient way for introducing the next thing, which is saying that, you know, we have too many states to represent in a table. Notice that I snuck in also the word deep for deep Q learning, because now I'm going to represent that function by a neural network. Just think of that as a function that takes as input the state and spits out either the value of all the actions or the probability with which you should pick a certain action. Okay. This is what is underneath AlphaGo. You have a particular representation, and let's say, of your game board. It's a 2D array, let's say. You feed that 2D array into a function, and that function tells you what the probabilities are for putting your white stone in position X, Y, or Z. And instead of having a regular function that you handcraft, you have a neural network, a function with billions, let's say, or millions of parameters. And the whole difficulty that you have in AlphaGo and in these methods is finding what those parameters should be. Right? The parameters I want to optimize such that for a given configuration in my system, it tells me which action is most probable. Most probable being, if I pick that action, I think I'm going to win. Okay? That was reinforcement learning very quickly in a nutshell. Any questions there? All right, so let's apply that to the error game. So the error game works as follows. We start with an empty board, let's say, for now, a perfect qubit. And now we have our opponent, let's say, Roger Melko here. He's behind the scenes, and he does something evil. He flips a qubit. Okay? But he doesn't tell us. That's what he does. He gives us this. Our task is to figure out which error happened. Okay? Because if we find out which error happened, we can undo it, and our qubit lives on happily ever after. So the game rules are as follows. You're given that board, and you have, from that moment on, it's a game you play only with yourself. You have every move you make, you can pick a particular location, and you can apply an X or a Z flip. Okay. And in this case, let's say we're given this. Let's say the most obvious thing we do is we flip an X here. Let's do that. At that moment, we ask, our opponent, what did you do? We compare it to what was done. In this case, if we pick this, we see we exactly undo that move. So we end up with an empty board, and we're happy. We win. You can try and convince yourself that we could have also done something like this. We flip these X's, and these X's give us exactly the same error pattern. These two plaquettes both have two X's flipped. They commute, so we get the same syndrome pattern. We compare that to this, and if we compare it, we see we would have flipped all four of these, and all four of these, they don't connect the boundaries. So we have no logical error. We didn't flip from a 1 to a 0. So we compare that. There should have been four X's here, four X's, but no connection from either end to the other. So we didn't flip our bits. We also win. What we could have done is flip these qubits, which would also have given us the correct error pattern, the correct syndrome pattern. But now if we compare it to what our opponent did, we find that we connected the boundaries and we lose. We did successfully remove the syndrome. There's no more red dots, but we flipped our qubit. Okay. So the whole, you know, given this picture, there's no way fundamentally for you to know what actually happened. So the question becomes one of statistics, of probability. Given this picture, what is the most likely set of errors that happened? And if we manage to build intuition for that by playing this game a billion times, we can use that to find, to hopefully avoid this particular correction. Okay. How do we do that in the game, in practice? The environment is described as follows. Forget about this terminator. Of course.
Right. But then it wouldn't just the answer be that, you know, the shortest yep. thing is the
In this particular example, in the trivial surface quadratura code, the answer is find the shortest string. That's called minimum weight perfect matching, and that, I'll come to why we want to do this regardless at the end. Yeah. All right, so we describe our system as follows. We have a state of the system, which in this case is just a picture of that syndrome. And we keep track of which actions you've applied, which qubits have you flipped so far, because you know, we need that in the end to compare the total error. And we have a reward. Again, this is where the difficulty is. So what I'll show you in the next slide, the reward here is just, did you win without introducing a logical error? Forget about this for the moment. And the agent's actions is just pick a qubit and flip it. You can flip it, you can do a Z flip or an X flip, but you pick one every move and hope that at some point you end up at an empty board, no more syndrome, and no logical error. As an easy benchmark for that, there's a typical thing people look at. I don't want to go into too much detail. What you see on the x-axis is the probability with which one of the physical qubits flips, okay, one of the vertices in that picture. Your superconducting qubit. And given that you have a particular error rate, if you have a strategy for correcting that error, which could be, like Maciek just suggested, this orange line, which is just find the shortest path. Given that correction algorithm, it tells you what the probability is that you introduce a logical error, that you do that correction, you remove the syndrome, but you accidentally connect the boundaries. That orange thing is close to optimal. With a little bit of training, that deep Q agent that we made, which just plays this game for a long time, basically follows the exact same procedure. It's a little bit worse here. I'm fairly confident that you can train it a bit longer. And it'll do just as good as.
Does this curve depend on the system size?
Yes. This is for those of you, this is for distance 5, which is fairly small by all other standards. Typically, you plot different system sizes and you find a crossing point in those curves, which will tell you an error threshold, which tells you if you're below that threshold, it just tells you that all you have to do is add more qubits, make your system larger. And you'll be able to correct. Practical issues there are very important, but yeah, I should have said indeed. Typically, people do this for different system sizes, and then for a given algorithm, find out where that crossing point is, so that you know with that algorithm I can correct all my errors as long as I make my system large enough. Okay. That's not exactly what I wanted to get at because I advertised fault tolerance settings. So that's a more interesting direction that I want to go in now.
Which is the total reward? There's no step-wise.
For this particular plot, the reward is just plus one if you win, and winning plus the condition that you do not introduce logical error and nothing otherwise. We tried many other things, including having a penalty if you flip the same qubit twice, because you don't have to do that in this case. You just undo whatever you did. The curve virtually remains identical. All you do is it trains a bit faster, because it doesn't explore the option of doing things again. But the performance doesn't really change in this case. All right. Fault tolerance setting is a bit more interesting. Let me go to this picture. We start with something empty again. Noise happens, our opponent flips a qubit, and then, forget about this middle column for now, noise, what we did before was given that error flip, we extract the syndrome, and this is where we started our game. Now, The point is, if you do that in an experiment, if you actually build that surface code, and you try and do that syndrome extraction, that requires measuring all those stabilizers. Things can go wrong in that measurement, and will go wrong in that measurement, which means that, for example, like we call that noise here, this is supposed to be a measurement error. It could be that there is a syndrome here, something goes wrong in your measurement, and you don't actually see that. It looks like nothing happened there. It could also be the other way around. It could be that you measure a syndrome point somewhere where, in fact, nothing happened. Okay? That makes the situation drastically different, actually, because now you cannot rely on this perfect syndrome. What people did before, and still doing that setting, is you need to go, if you want to be able to do anything useful there, you need to go to so-called syndrome volumes, which means I need to give you a few consecutive syndromes. Because it could be that if I measure that, if I have that syndrome measurement, and I do the syndrome measurement again, maybe in that case, that measurement that failed before didn't fail this time. So if I, multiple errors can happen in the meantime, I do that syndrome extraction again. On that syndrome extraction, something else can happen, can also be bad, but in particular now I see that there's an error here. So I don't know if that error happened this time on the actual syndrome, or if that should have been there before. I cannot tell from this, but at least if I have a couple of such pictures, I can see some of the red dots pop up once or disappear once, but if they're there in all the other pictures, that was probably a measurement error. That red dot just happened to be incorrectly measured once. Okay. So we encode that faulty measurement in statistics of multiple measurements. Okay, that's the setting that we consider. That requires a couple of snapshots of this game board. That's what we feed into that's our new game. Instead of one picture, I give you seven pictures, six pictures. We can, you know, play with how many pictures I give you. And from that set of pictures, I now ask you, what was the true underlying pattern of errors that happened? Okay. That's what the reinforcement learning decoder is trained to give us. Okay. So I should say, winning the game in this case is no longer a question of removing all the syndromes. What we switch to doing, which seems more robust, is trying to keep that logical information alive, which means I give you a starting error pattern. I tell you in the beginning, my qubit is perfect, is what I want it to be, and as time goes, errors happen, and I ask you to teach yourself the following. Correct those errors as you go, as I give you that syndrome volume, and just keep doing that for as long as you can until you happen to hit that logical error, until you introduce a logical error, and try and make that time as long as you can. Try and correct and prevent that logical error happening for as long as you can. That's the reward system that we have in this case. So here we have, instead of the syndrome, we have that syndrome volume, a couple of them. Still keep track of the action history. There's an extra state, an extra bit in this case that indicates whether or not you have that logical error. You keep going until you have that logical error. If that happens, you terminate. Game over, you lose. You restart. In order for this to work better, I'm not sure if it's required, we found that it trained better, it's an empirical thing. We give the agent another action. We tell it, it can basically say, I think we're done. I think I corrected all the errors. You can now add more errors if you want. Okay. It's like an indicator for the agent to say, I think your system is good. Give me more errors. If it does this, that's a good sign. At least that should be a positive, that should be rewarded positively, because that would be the case in which it says no more errors. Okay. There's a positive reward associated with the agent choosing this action. The whole system then, I'm almost done. The whole system, you know, it's a complicated picture, but works like this. You have that initial state, perfect state. syndrome extraction, multiple errors happen. You get multiple snapshots of that syndrome. Those multiple slices are meant to represent, are fed to the agent. The agent implements some particular strategy on which we have a referee. I should have said that before. In order to determine whether or not that state terminated, you need to know if you touched the boundaries, right? And touching the boundaries, if you want to know if you did that, you need to know which errors happened, okay? Which is cheating, because it means you would have to know which errors happened, you know, to check whether you hit the boundaries, which we don't want to assume. So to do that, we have a referee decoder, which is basically that same decoder that just does minimum weight perfect matching. It just says, if I do the most naive thing, given that particular syndrome, did I introduce an error, yes or no? If the referee says, I cannot decode this, then the game is also over. That's a technical thing, don't worry about that if you didn't catch that. That's an extra stopping condition. Okay? If a single shot decoder says, I cannot correct this, then we don't have to continue training. So the whole thing is repeated, that's it. The network tries to correct, at some point says, I think I'm done, it restarts. Or if the referee says, you're done, we also restart. So the result of that, as a demonstration, again for distance 5, fairly small, I admit. The same thing on the x-axis, the error rate of your physical qubits. And here the black line, the lifetime, like how long in iterations, let's say if we talk about seconds, this is how many, the error rate per second, this is how many seconds that qubit for distance 5, which means 5 of those plaquettes, 5 by 5, how many seconds you can wait before you, on average, introduce a string that touches the boundaries. Black line, if you don't do anything. If you do something, namely our reinforcement learning agent, you see at least here we don't do any better. This just happens too fast. For the smaller error rates, you have two orders of magnitude of lifetime enhancement for these qubits. I should say these are, for the expert, these are idling qubits. I don't assume that during this correction, computations are being done with this qubit. This is just a state of a system, just idling, doing nothing, errors happen, and you want to keep that qubit in that particular state for as long as you can. Okay, so let me wrap up.
Yep. P physical equals P measurement, what's the threshold here? Is it 0.01?
Which threshold?
Just the threshold here in this model, right? You have
in the fault tolerant case, you mean, if you do the syndrome volumes? So if you don't have the fault tolerant measurement, I think the threshold is somewhere around 0.11, much higher. If you do have faulty measurements, I think the threshold is somewhere around 0.012. I don't know the exact number. It's a factor 10 smaller than not having measurement errors. But, yeah.
The threshold, is that defined as how you could protect one qubit in the thermodynamic limit?
Yeah, that's threshold. Defined. That's a threshold. Yeah.
For error rates below the threshold.
For error rates below
you could preserve it for infinitely long and with an infinite system size.
Correct, with an infinite system size. If you do that on something like the toric code, though, I mean, for the toric code, and you correct it with minimum weight perfect matching, meaning you take the errors and you connect them with the shortest path possible, that threshold is something like 0.11 error rate. Below that, so if you manage to make your Majorana modes have error rates below that threshold, it means that if you scale up that system to the thermodynamic limit, to the infinite limit, you can suppress errors as much as you want. That means that physical, this is not this plot, that logical error rate, you want to bring that down to 10 to the minus 14 or something very small. I think 10 to the minus 14 is a classical computer limit, in which in the toric code requires a million qubits, a million or something, or even more physical qubits for you to have one logical qubit. In the toric code, you get two, but So I'm not sure if that threshold is the right thing to look at. That's what I'm saying, actually. It might not be the most useful metric.
But how does the time that you can protect it for scale with the size? If you're below the it's a threshold, really. It's a sharp phase transition, in some sense.
The threshold is a property of the algorithm that you use to fix, to decode the error.
And it's a qualitative.
If you go to the infinite limit, that's a sharp threshold. That's a phase transition. If you have error rates of your physical qubits below that threshold, then in the thermodynamic limit you can correct. If you go epsilon above, you cannot.
But correct for how long?
This threshold state. This is not the threshold we're talking about now. Is not a statement for how long you can correct.
It doesn't
involve. There's no time. It's just, can you perfectly correct that error, yes or no, in the thermodynamic limit. All of those models, so forget about the time, all of those models can be exactly mapped to spin systems, and in those you can in principle calculate the phase transition as a function of temperature that maps to the threshold. Yeah.
But you could have error correction protocols that aren't perfect, right?
You can, yeah, sure.
And then they don't saturate at the theoretical threshold.
Right, yeah. You have, yeah.
And then for some error correction protocols, you must not have theory.
No thresholds.
Phase transition.
Yeah, there are other, yeah. There are, I don't know how to say that concisely, but there are also, like I said, the threshold is a property of that error correction algorithm you implement, right? And you might have an error correction algorithm that happens to have no threshold, for example, and then, yeah.
Does it depend on the noise model or is
yep.
it an algorithm?
Yeah. So for a given, if you have noise models, if you have correlated noise, let's say qubits want to flip at the same time, then minimum weight perfect matching is no longer a good thing to do, for example. Depends on the noise model too. Yeah.
You know, yes. Do you have like benchmark algorithms to compare this RL approach to instead of the single qubit?
Yeah. Yeah, so that minimum weight perfect matching or Blossom 5, for example, is something you can compare to.
But for this multiple,
in the fault tolerant case? In the fault tolerant case?
Like to kind of algorithm.
Yeah, for exactly that, for example. I think also the cellular automata can work in that case. Don't pin me down on that, I should check that. But
So with minimum weight matching, you can do X and Z errors pretty well, but it doesn't do that well for Y errors because it doesn't correlate them.
Yep.
Can this spot those correlations and do a lot better?
That's exactly the point, yeah. For those errors, it does better. We tried depolarizing noise. We didn't try correlated noise at different points.
Spatially
correlated noise, but these things are in there. These things are in the simulation, in the game, and
then is it? Presumably, do good for like really
biased
noise or things like that as well.
Yeah, so that's, I think, let me make that statement right now then, which is what Maciek asked before also. Why do you want to do this instead of minimum weight perfect matching, for example? Well, one is because things like these Y errors or distant, like spatial correlations, we didn't put them in, but we would have to change exactly nothing in our code to see if that works, right? The rules of the game change, underlying the rules, but it's still the same game. You still, you know, your moves are still flip qubits, yes or no. And that's the point. In your physical implementation, it could be that Majorana mode number 17 is just a bit more error prone than, you know, Majorana mode number 6 because of some capacitance in your system. Something that you wouldn't want to have to deal with manually, right? Trying to manually tweak your minimum weight perfect matching algorithm to favor qubit number 16 because it just happens to flip more often. It's just, no one's going to do that. I think we can agree on that. If you train it with this approach, you don't have to care. It will figure it out itself. It will just see from, it plays a million games and it realizes at some point that qubit 16 is just more error prone, right? So that's an advantage. Other things is like for color codes, for correlated codes, we don't have, as far as I know at least, algorithms that are close to optimal like minimum weight perfect matching is. And this might well find them, with the caveat that it doesn't tell you what the strategy is, right? From that point of view, it's a black box that you give the input and it tells you what the error is. It doesn't necessarily tell you how it gets to that conclusion. That's, I think, a problem with interpretable machine learning in general, but maybe we can try and design some test cases and see what the algorithm does in those cases to tease out what that strategy is.
Have you tried it with presumably you have to be able to simulate it to play this game.
Yeah.
So have you tried with coherent errors or non-polio errors?
No. No, we tried this so far. Yeah. No spatial.
You have to do a poly twirl or something if you want to simulate the large distance.
You can in principle even try fully circuit level noise if you want to do the whole extraction of the syndrome also in there. All these things are sort of lower level that at least the algorithm that we use to train it doesn't care about. It's just something that happens underneath.
Something can simulate the syndrome statistics.
Yep. If you have such a code, you can plug it in basically. Right? That's all I wanted to say at least. Feel free to ask more questions.
During the training, do you have to know what errors occurred and then compare what the algorithm did to reward it? This is something that...
To do the reward. So we check. Yeah, so that's where the referee comes in.
Okay, so...
You need to have a way of saying, now, so at this point, an error happened, a logical error happened, yes or no, and that's what the referee tells you, basically. But you don't need, there's other works in which you generate a data set with errors that happened, and the corresponding correction that you'd have to do, and you can do supervised learning, right? You say, for this particular pattern, if you see this syndrome, apply this error. If you see that syndrome, apply that correction, sorry. And then if you sample those, you cannot go through all of them, but you can sample those and see if you can extract that function, which becomes a classification issue, right? What is the most likely logical error that happened in that system? Those work, that's exactly what we use for the referee, single shot.
I was thinking of a scenario where you can interact with a quantum computer.
Yep.
This is how you do your training, but yep. Then it's not clear how you would reward if you don't know what is happening there.
Yeah, you exactly hit
a reward.
You exactly hit the Achilles heel, right? You need to design that reward system, which might not have to be did an error occur at the end or not. It could also be that you implement this during your computation and need to verify whatever the outcome is.
If you really want to do it on a physical machine, you could try using that state to do something, right?
You could try using the resulting state to do a computation.
The resulting state at time t, use for some quantum computation. If the computation fails, you give it negative reward. Then at least you don't have to design explicitly knowledge, right? You're just saying that it's still computationally useful or useless. Right?
One scheme is to assume that you have a verified quantum computer, you do a swap test, and then...
That's how we verify software, right? You have a whole bunch of tests, you build the code, if all the tests pass, you hope...
Exactly. That's okay.
Also, don't
know how errors happen, right? You just run it and say, it still does the job. So if you use this whatever entangled state for some quantum sensing or whatever, and it fails, then...
Yeah, which boils down again to the designing the reward system.
So instead of using a Q-learning, you use a policy gradient. You can just look at the strategy.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things that I avoided saying. In that initial plot where I showed you the benchmark compared to minimum weight perfect matching, that was the full AlphaGo algorithm, the full policy tree search, Monte Carlo tree search algorithm. The Q-learning does exactly the same, right? Just that particular plot, the data was done with that, which is the full algorithm that Google uses to do this. It works. In practice, it just takes much longer because you have to do that tree search, right? In the Q-learning, you don't. It's just a neural network that you backpropagate the error. So for the fault tolerant setting, where you have much larger input, etc., we did the Q-learning. I'm fairly certain that the policy gradient iteration also works for that case. The practical issue is, you know, Google learns how to play the game of Go in let's say, 4 days or 4 hours now. Between their hardware and my laptop, there's a factor 1700, right? So 4 days and 1700, I'm not going to be able to do that, right? So it's a practical thing, but I'm fairly certain that given the hardware, you can also do policy gradient on this, which is a bit better in the sense that it's more interpretable.
Great, thank you, everybody.